I'm Sarah Lomax, and this is Twice as Good. We have a real treat for you today. We are going to be talking about the attacks on affirmative action, diversity, equity, and inclusion, and just the retrenchment around the pledges and promises that were made in the aftermath of the racial justice protests in 2020. We are only 4 years from that moment, and so much has changed in the landscape. And so today we're joined by an incredible scholar, Professor Mark Anthony Neal. He is the chair of the African American Studies Department at Duke University. And if you've been watching the media, especially Black media, you know that something really consequential has recently happened at Duke, where they rolled back a scholarship program called the Reggie Scholarship, named for Reginaldo Howard. And Mark is going to tell us about him in just a minute. But let me welcome you, Professor Mark Anthony Neal. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Sarah.
Yeah, so you've been at Duke for about 20 years, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
So tell us a little bit about the Reginaldo Howard Scholarship and what it's meant for Black students at Duke University.
Reginaldo Howard was a Black student who was the first Black student elected to head student government at Duke University back in 1976. Unfortunately, before he was able to take office and return back for campus over the summer, he died in an automobile accident. And this was effectively around 13 years after the first Black students were admitted to Duke. And as a way to memorialize Reginald Howard, the Reginald Howard Scholars was started in 1979 as a merit scholarship for African-American students who embodied Reginald Howard's sense and legacy of leadership and high academic standards.
But in the context of the world that we're living in right now, where we know that there is a full-on assault on colleges and universities and Black and brown voices and presence at these universities, if you're reading between the lines, what does it mean that they are, I would say, eliminating a Black merit scholarship that has been in place since 1979? And there's a real community of these Reggie scholars that have made a tremendous impact on Duke.
On Duke and the world, to be quite honest. You know, for me, it immediately felt as though the university was retreating from some of its commitments to diversity and equity. You know, what makes Duke different in this context, we can look just, 8 miles down the road, to our friends at the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill, which is a public institution. And they, of course, are also dealing with attacks on DEI. Duke is a private institution. And the Reginald Howard Scholars is not an admissions program, which is what the SCOTUS decision targeted. It is a scholarship program.
The U.S. Supreme Court today dealt a major blow to affirmative action in higher education.
In rulings divided along ideological lines, the court's 6-justice conservative majority said the schools discriminated against white and Asian American applicants.
The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled universities cannot consider race and ethnicity in university admissions. Now, this judgment ends a decades-old practice of affirmative action.
So it felt as though they were preparing for something that wasn't actually under attack in this moment. It felt like one of the most conservative interpretations of the SCOTUS decision. And on the surface, given the choices that they're making about transitioning the Reginald Howard Scholars to something that would be more impactful to Black students and others, it feels as though they're stealing from Peter to pay Paul. And the Reginald Howard Scholars, were essentially what was going to be sacrificed in order to do that. My immediate reaction when the university, finally talked to the Faculty Senate, last week about some of these decisions is that, the quality of life for Black students at Duke's campus is one thing. The Reginald Howard Scholars represented one of the most iconic and sustainable images that the university has some sort of commitment to Black people. across the board, right? It's probably the most timeless example of that commitment. And for me, it didn't seem as though the one thing had anything to do with the other. You could still maintain the Reginald Howard's Merit Scholarship, but also do better in terms of the quality of life of Black students on Duke's campus.
So just speak to us about this quality of life issue on the campus. I mean, I think that anyone who's gone to a predominantly white institution knows that just based on culture and sheer numbers and things like that. But what exactly are they saying they're going to address in terms of quality of life by transitioning the Reggie Scholarship to this other program?
So let me just, you know, first of all, accept that Duke is not an outlier in this regard. As you mentioned, you know, most Black students at PWIs, you know, face a challenge in terms of, you know, feeling as though the institution belongs to them. Much of the funding of the Reginald Howard Scholarship is going to move over to the Mary Lou Williams Center, which has been a cultural center here at Duke University itself for many, many decades, and has had a tremendous impact on the quality of life for students. And it feels as though the university chose as a way to better resource the Mary Lou Williams Center that they would use some of the funding towards the Reginald Howard Scholarship to do that. What I think is important to understand here that, you know, the Reginald Howard Scholars Program is an academic program. The Mary Lou Williams Center is a cultural center that does support academic endeavors, but those are two very different things. And I don't think we can ever conflate the idea of the pursuit of high scholarship for Black students and recognizing those students who deserve merit. Now, you know, part of the response that Duke had said, and I understand this, that everyone who comes to Duke is meritorious. I get that, right? Every institution wants to say that. But, you know, as I screened and look at some of the Black media responses to this, as if Duke was retreating from its commitment, stated commitments that it had made. And there are many folks who didn't believe that even when Duke made those commitments, that they were legitimate commitments, right? That they really were all in on these questions of diversity and equity. I mean, for many folks, and including myself, it felt as though this was Duke just being Duke. And that ultimately, you know, the impact of that is that, in my mind, many of these students who would have been able to become Reginald Howard Scholars, you know, will choose to go down to other institutions, right? That's just my frank opinion. I don't know how it's going to play out, right? But definitely that was an appeal. And it's still not an easy sell for Black students, and more importantly, for Black parents to send their students to Duke University sometimes, not knowing what kind of environment that's going to be here.
Sure. Well, and I mean, the reality is the student body is only 8% Black currently. We've seen in California with the 1993 or 1996, I can't remember, the decision on the public universities in California, they went from 8% Black representation to now they're down to 4%. So there is a direct correlation between these kinds of decisions where they take affirmative action and race-based elements out of the admissions process.
Absolutely.
It absolutely has a devastating impact on the diversity on the campus. So what is kind of the Black experience currently, and how do you think it's going to be impacted by this decision?
So as you know, as you mentioned earlier, I've been here at Duke for 20 years, and you know, I would be lying if I said the quality of life of Black students and faculty hasn't gotten better over those 20 years. All you have to do is look at the upper administration of Duke University now, where we have our first Black provost. We have our second and consecutive dean of the Black dean of the graduate school. Our dean of communications, right? Vice president of communications is an African-American man who was recruited from Howard University. So if I just look at it from the optics of the institution, it is definitely a different place, right? Folks are more receptive. The fact that, you know, my department, the Department of African and African-American Studies, which I've led now since 2017, you know, has a certain amount of respect on campus, though probably more respect beyond the campus than we do on campus, right? So I would be remiss not to admit that there have been significant changes. But the reality is that, you know, Duke has a longer history in which people have raised concerns, right? I've had colleagues who talked about concerns about sending their children to Duke. Again, Duke is an institution in the Deep South, in a historically African-American city. And again, Duke's not an outlier in terms of concerns that parents parents might have in sending their kids to a place like Duke or otherwise. But, you know, what strikes me as really important in this moment, right, as we're, you know, as Duke is having a conversation or wants to have a conversation about the value of merit scholarships, there are other merit scholarships at Duke. And there are Black students who get those and, you know, multicultural students who get access to those. But they're not having any conversations at the moment about getting rid of those merit scholarship programs. Right. When the discussion came up, the first one that they chose was the one that was for African-American students. Mm. Even as administration said, you know, as we go forward and rethink merit scholarships, you know, these other merit scholarships are on campus, we want to have the input of the full Duke community and faculty. You know, we were not given that opportunity, you know, when they decided to transition the original Howard scholars. So I think, you know, if I'm being honest, Duke is a better place. If I had children who went to college now, I probably wouldn't think twice about sending them to Duke because I know the quality of the education, the quality of my colleagues as teachers and as researchers and scholars, right? But the way that Duke chose to fold in this moment makes me consider what other things they're going to be so willing to fold on going in the forward, right? If you were so willing to do such a narrow and conservative interpretation of the SCOTUS decision, right? What else are you going to run from, right? What are you willing to stand on? And you know, we are in a moment where many institutions, including my own, have chose to embrace a culture of aversion, risk aversion, right? They don't want to take risk. And I understand that on so many levels. As I'm looking at what's happening at Columbia now, what has happened in the past in terms of the leadership at the University of Pennsylvania and the leadership of Harvard University and Claudia Gay, right? I can understand why institutions are feeling as though they're going to be targeted, right? But they have to choose to stand up for something other than risk aversion.
Absolutely. And I guess, you know, I want to zoom out a little bit because, you know, we're age peers. And I'm curious, when you were in college, like when I was in college, affirmative action was like very much core to recruiting and retaining Black students. And the administration, you know, they were very upfront and outspoken about it. And I'm curious, like, you've been at Duke for 20 years, you're the chair of the African American Studies Department, and, you know, you were a student during a time when affirmative action was like, it was kind of codified in the admissions process. And it open doors for a lot of Black students. And so I just want you to like reflect on your personal college experience and the evolution of what you think the college experience for Black students are now at a place like Duke. And a lot of, like you said, a lot of these elite universities, PWIs, have very similar, you know, cultures.
You know, I'll be honest. I went to the State University of New York College at Fredonia, small liberal arts public institution about 45 miles southwest of Buffalo. I came into the State University of New York at Fredonia, and I was in a program called the Educational Opportunity Program, which was a program that was designed by then State Senator, State Assemblyman Arthur O'Eve out of Buffalo, to give opportunity to underrepresented students and also underserved and also students who were financially strapped to be able to go to college. I would not have been able to afford to go to college and get the kinds of services that allowed me to become a good student without affirmative action in that sense in what the Educational Opportunity Program represented. Arthur Eve also had the foresight to create a graduate fellowship to allow folks that if they were interested to go into graduate school. And I was supported, you know, for my 5 years in graduate school by the Arthur Eve graduate fellowship. You know, I wouldn't be in this position now without folks understanding that at various points, there has to be an intervention made that allows for folks who don't normally have access to these institutions. And when they do have access, to make sure that there's a support system for them to be successful there. You know, a place like Duke is a different reality, right? Many students are coming from prep schools. Many students across race, right, have the financial resources to be able to come to Duke, at least to do so in a way that doesn't put their families in some sort of trepidation, right? But there still are working class and lower middle class students here. And, you know, programs, you know, not, you know, in the case of the Reginald Howard Scholars, it was strictly about academic merit, right? But there's so many other programs that have been enacted on these campuses to make it easier for students to be able to be successful and survive at these institutions. The impact of that diversity, right, speaks to the quality of leadership and the quality of intelligence in terms of academic leadership and other things. You know, what we are able to achieve at a new, as a nation is connected to the diversity of talents, the pool of diversity that we have in this country for people to be successful. The fact that there are so many people who are so short-sighted in that long game, and I'm going to be honest, you know, many of these attacks on DEI feel like now at the moment that on some level, the playing field is leveled, right? That there are many whites who simply don't want to have to be in competition with Blacks who share their skill sets and their talents, and in some cases are far better suited for their positions.
Well, I would just say, I mean, plus one to that, but also the thing that drives me crazy is that when we look at racial health disparities, when we look at wealth disparities, racial wealth and health disparities, the needle has not moved.
The needle has not moved
from 2020 when this big outpouring was happening. And now we see this like incredible clapback. And I question whether the playing field has been leveled.
Right.
I think that it was moving incrementally, slightly in that direction. But when you look at the hardcore statistics, you know, it's going to take 300 years for Black folks to be on parity from a wealth standpoint with white folks. And so nothing fundamentally has changed, but yet the perception and
the optics of it, right? So again, you know, to clarify my point, I mean, if you look at the highest levels of achievement, and I'm speaking specifically in terms of academics, right? And again, that Claudine Gay could have become the president of Harvard, right? Speaks to a certain kind of notion of parity. Right. But of course, that parity isn't represented in the board of trustees at Harvard, right, that ultimately had the power to take her down. Right. And to the point that you make, for the vast majority of folks who are never going to make it to a Duke, who are never going to go to college, right, and who don't have access to the professional training and the education to have high income jobs, right, your point is well taken, right, that the needle has not moved at all. And, you know, what I always bothered me about the 2020 moment in George Floyd was how quickly so many entities capitulated to the pressure that was being poured on them and really what was a short period of time. And it struck me for a couple of reasons. One, you could have done this 10 years earlier, 15 years earlier, right? We didn't need to have the kind of social unrest that we saw for that to happen. But it also felt very much performative, a performative gesture, right? And we always, those of us who've been doing this work for a long time, either literally in the DEI space or folks who study race and gender and society, knew that it was going to be a clapback, and the clapback was going to be much more intense than anything that we might have gained. And we're seeing this now. And, you know, many of these institutions, I think, you know, did a disservice to themselves and also Black faculty and students and Black workers and all those kinds of things, and not recognizing that there was going to be a clapback. How many folks, for instance, had an opportunity to get a DEI type job, right, 2 years ago with the idea that finally these institutions were going to get it right, only to have, say, if you're in Texas, to have the state legislature basically make DEI offices illegal, right? North Carolina is looking at the same thing, right? Florida is looking at the same thing, right? For them to not have been prepared for what was obviously going to be a pushback, right? On some level, it's negligence on their part.
You know, we have a long history in this country of seeing the clapback. You know, we saw it with Reconstruction. We see it every time there's...
We saw it in 2016.
Right. So what, from where you sit, knowing history, what is the response?
I think one of the things that I'm afraid of in this moment is that you know, one of the groups of people that can move the needle are young folks. And while I'm not saying that electoral politics are the end all, right, that that's the only game, there are many ways to move the political needle besides going out to vote. You know, we have a younger generation of folks who just simply don't believe in the franchise, right? Mm-hmm. It's disconcerting on the one level, given that we know the folks and the level of folks who made sacrifices in order for us to get the right to vote, right? And of course, we're seeing even that being repealed, right? In certain instances, pushback from our ability to vote. But I don't think young folks see that as a viable option, right? I mean, one of the unfortunate things about, you know, 8 years of Obama, you know, many young folks grew up with the best face, the best version of America. It quickly turned to something that many of us had long recognized, because that's what it was right before 2008 and even during, right? You know, yeah. It's no surprise that we had a Black president. You know, Black Lives Matter starts in that moment, because even with a Black president, right, it would still open season on Black bodies, right, and Black people. So, you know, that's the thing that concerns me, right? We have to think really thoughtfully beyond, and social media is great, but engagement has to be beyond the optics and the surface of retweeting and hashtags, right? We have to get back to old school organizing. And unfortunately, I think we might be two generations removed from Black folks in which that was always their call to duty. We have to get back, I think, to that ethic of being on the ground and organizing. Now, you know, I see the young folks up at Columbia. I'm heartened, right? And not even having to discuss the specific politics of it, right? But they were enough of a threat in their willingness to come together and organize that the president of the university called for the police to come on campus.
Continue as students protest the Israel-Hamas war.
It's been seven straight days for Columbia University students, and it's growing in other places.
Pro-Palestine protesters are outraged there by the school's investment in military weapon manufacturers, and hundreds of students have been camped out for several days, and police have just moved in on them.
Yeah.
I mean, we really haven't seen stuff like this since Kent State. And many of these young folks have no idea of what happened at Kent State, right? And why that was such a remarkable moment, you know, in American society and for student activists.
And what I think is so deliberate is this attack on colleges and universities, because they know that that is where young people get activated. They get
right. Where they get information, right? It's an attack on the pipeline of the exchange of knowledge. The way that critical race theory was an attack on K through 12, the DEI attacks are an attack on what's happening in colleges and universities, right? They really don't want a transference of knowledge of resistance from folks who experienced it, from folks who have an academic knowledge of it, to be able to pass those that information and strategies on to college students, for that information to be available for K through 12. And I think for many Black communities, right, we have to really get back to that practice of thinking about Saturday school and after school schools, right, where we sit down and we introduce the history of our folks, of our people, of our resistance, of our achievements, right, K through 12 and in college, right, so that folks can really be armed with the kind of information that they need to be able to survive and thrive going forward.
I just want to thank you so much. We've been talking with Professor Mark Anthony Neal. He is the chair of the African American Studies Department at Duke University. We've been talking about this latest assault on DEI and affirmative action and just Black representation at these major elite universities. So thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Sarah.
And that's Twice as Good. This is a podcast that we're going to start really delving into these issues of DEI and affirmative action and just the retrenchment. We're calling it the Great Retrenchment. And so we hope that you'll continue to join us on Twice as Good. This is a part of URL Media. URL stands for Uplift, Respect, and Love. And we're a network of 32 Black and Brown media organizations that come together to share content and revenues for greater sustainability of Black and Brown media. So if you want to watch this, you can also catch the podcast on YouTube. But download the podcast on any of the platforms that you seek podcasts. Thanks so much. We'll see you next time.